Thanks, John, and thanks, everyone. And please be bear with me. I have a little bit of a cold, so I'm hoping I'll be audible, but my voice is not like it usually is. I'm here to talk about urban heat islands, excessive heat events, some of the mitigation and response strategies to address these phenomena, and to give you a little flavor for some of the activities taking place around the U.S. So just jumping right in. Okay, the term urban heat island refers to elevated surface and air temperatures associated with built-up areas compared to more natural surrounding land cover. And the colorful images are surface temperatures, thermal images, generally remotely sensed, and that profile just kind of shows you what a typical atmospheric heat island looks like. And it's mainly a nighttime phenomenon because during the day you have infrastructure absorbing solar energy, and then at night, or as soon as the sun goes down, that infrastructure slowly releases that heat. And the causes are urbanization. You're replacing natural land cover with heat-absorbing, impervious built environment. Urban form plays a role. For example, when you have a lot of tall buildings about the same height, and you know, have narrow streets, you kind of trap solar energy and reduce airflow. Anthropogenic sources of heat play a role. For example, waste heat from cars and air conditioners. And then there are many influences on the heat island. For example, weather. When you have clear, windless days, you have larger heat islands than when you have windy, cloudy days. Now, the reason we care about urban heat islands, and they're a year-round phenomenon, but we mainly focus on the summertime impacts, because those can be very negative. For example, Lawrence Berkeley National Lab has found that in cities of about 100,000 or more, they did the study for LA, but they found it in multiple cities. For every 1 degree Fahrenheit increase in temperature, you get a corresponding 1.5 to 2% increase in electricity demand. Areas like Arizona are finding that they're having longer peak periods, which are periods of highest energy demand, where all your generation sources are running, and that tends to be the dirtiest. So associated with the increases in energy demand, you have higher air pollution levels, greenhouse gas emissions, and if all things are equal, as this graphic shows, you have with higher temperatures, you have higher rates of ground level ozone formation. Now with water, there's basically two impacts. One is elevated temperatures increase water demand, and in drought, in areas that are dry, that can be a big problem. And then in terms of water quality, one researcher has found that a 100-degree pavement, and that's very common in a hot, sunny summer day, a 73-degree rainfall can heat up to over 95 degrees. And, you know, the majority of rainfall in our urban areas becomes runoff. So you have this heated runoff draining into open water bodies, which can cause thermal shock and harm aquatic ecosystems. With human health, urban heat islands can exacerbate heat-related illnesses and deaths. Now, the other three impacts, they're being researched, and there is some data there, but it's not quite as strong as with the above impacts. Now, excessive heat events are a bit different. They are basically defined as summertime weather that is substantially hotter and or more humid than average for a location at that time of year. And excessive heat events definitely contribute to death and mortality, or death and morbidity. And in the U.S., there are more deaths from excessive heat events than any other natural hazard. Now, the populations most at risk are the elderly, the low-income, people living alone, people living in cities, and people living in highly variable climates because they're not as acclimated to the heat. So people living in, you know, Chicago, New York. Now, the key strategies that we promote to reduce urban heat islands are increasing urban vegetative cover, which includes green roofs, and installing cool roofs and cool pavements, and I'll talk about those a bit more. Before I talk about the strategies, though, I just want to show you what an average area looks like in terms of land cover and peak surface temperatures. Now, I think the most interesting thing from this graphic is, you know, on a hot, sunny summer day, rooftop surfaces can be almost twice the ambient air temperature, whereas vegetation provides a cooling effect. It's generally as warm or cooler than the ambient air temperature. It depends on how much moisture the vegetation has. Now, trees and vegetation work by providing shade, so reducing heat gain into buildings or shading surfaces, as well as through evapotranspiration. Now, green roofs, I'm not going to go into the technology in much detail, just in the interest of time, but basically there are two types of green roofs, extensive or low profiles, the new name that people are using, versus intensive or high profile, and they vary in the amount of growing media they use, on their weight, on their cost, with extensive or low profile roofs being the cheaper, simpler version, basically vegetation on a roof, and the intensive version being almost like a park, like Millennium Park in Chicago is an example of an intensive rooftop garden. Now the benefits, well, if you strategically plant shade trees around buildings, you can get substantial air conditioning or energy savings. And from a heat health perspective, it's really, you know, reducing the heat gain into the building that plays a role there. USDA Forest Service has found that a 10% increase in canopy can result in up to a 3.5 degree Fahrenheit decrease in midday temperatures. And then you have the other, you know, air pollution removal and other benefits as well, stormwater management. Now, cool roofing, I'm assuming you might not know as much about cool roofing as you would about trees and vegetation. By cool, I'm referring to materials that reflect solar energy. So there are basically two types of roofs in the roofing market, flat or low slope roofs, which generally apply to commercial buildings, or slope roofs, which apply to residential buildings. And there's a whole host of products, but in particular, with the flat or low slope roof market, there's really been a lot of advancements. And most of the products are bright white currently because they reflect in the visible portion of the spectrum. Now, with residential products, you really don't want bright white roofs. So Lawrence Berkeley Lab in particular, but working with other, you know, manufacturers and Oak Ridge National Lab and others, have developed cool colored products where they reflect in the near-infrared portion of the spectrum, so you can still have a colored product that reflects sunlight and stays cool. Okay, the benefits, again, energy savings, temperature reduction, and again, by reducing heat gain into the building, and the roof, particularly in the summertime when the sun's high in the sky, is a big percentage of heat gain is through the roof. You, again, can reduce indoor air temperatures, improving indoor comfort. Okay, and cool pavements. I'm not going to go into this too much, but just to say that we are doing work in this area. We've just succeeded in launching a Transportation Research Board subcommittee on this topic, but they're very complex, and the technologies aren't quite there the same way they are with roofing products. Okay, now in terms of excessive heat events, you know, urban heat island reduction and urban heat island reduction strategies, those are kind of long-term. With excessive heat events, the immediate response that you need to save lives, to address that, my coworker, I did not work on this, so I don't want to take credit for it, launched the excessive heat events guidebook with cooperation from the CDC, FEMA, and NOAA, and my coworker Jason Samenow really did a lot of work on this. And they came up with 5 recommendations, with I think the 3rd and 4th being the most important kind of response, or not most important, but ones to focus on. Response preparation and response actions. And I'll actually talk at the end of my presentation about what Philadelphia is doing to kind of develop those a little more. Now, okay, so that basically explains, I hope, in a nutshell, what an urban heat island is, what excessive heat events are, and some of the mitigation strategies. Now I just want to give you a flavor for some of the activities that are taking place around the U.S. Dr. Jay Golden with the Arizona State University is using historical data to look at the role that urban form, urban morphology, the built environment, plays in relation to heat-related deaths and other incidents, heat-related incidents. So that colorful graphic kind of shows surface temperatures as well as 911 emergency calls. My coworker Jason Samenow is doing similar work in Phoenix and Philadelphia, and just going back, Jay's doing that work in multiple cities. Jason Samenow is doing similar work, but less sophisticated and much more back of the envelope, but you may be interested in it anyway. Then the University of Michigan, and I should have put Harvard is also associated with this, they are working to look at what communities are doing in terms of heat wave response programs, excessive heat event response programs, with the goal of trying to improve response programs. So they're doing a survey through ICLEI, the International Council for Local Environmental Initiatives. And that's just a sampling of some of the work that's going on. Now, in terms of advancing urban heat island reduction strategies, there are labeling programs, and particularly for cool roofs, these labeling programs have done a lot to advance the market. It's really, you know, grown exponentially. Demonstration projects, you'll see a lot of cities doing green roof demonstration projects in particular. In terms of education, I just want to point out EarthGage is a great program that the National Environmental Education Foundation, along with the American Meteorological Society, are working on, where, you know, they found that people watch the news to hear the weather forecast. So they're inserting environmental tips through broadcast meteorologists, and they're coming out with a course on the built environment and weather, which Urban Heat Islands play a role there, so I'm involved in that. And I think it's just a great resource, and it's not just for meteorologists. Anyone can access the website and take the course, or plus you can also work with your community to become an EarthGage city. Incentives, utilities in particular, are giving many incentives, for example, giving out free shade trees or giving cool roof rebates. And then there are many ordinances and standards and codes that are being passed, particularly for cool roofs and vegetation, to advance them. Now, just in terms of examples of local action, I want to point out Philadelphia, where, you know, health is really the driver there. They're doing urban heat island work and excessive heat event response work. I'm almost positive, are the first city to have a heat health watch warning system, which is a more sophisticated way of identifying heat waves than the typical National Weather Service heat index. And they've also, through their weatherization program, incorporated cool roof treatments as part of their suite of, you know, energy efficiency treatments that they do to these low-income homes. And what they were finding is, you know, most heat-related deaths occur in top-floor, un-air-conditioned row homes. So, you know, by putting a cool roof on these row homes, you're reducing indoor air temperatures, and they took measurements and found that maximum air temperature reduction on the top floor was 3 degrees Fahrenheit, which can be substantial in a heat wave. And to date, they've coated over 500 rooftops. And not only, you know, are they incorporating into their weatherization program, but they also have a very extensive outreach program. So there's, you know, a heat alert, and there's lots of media calls. They have a extensive network. They have a buddy system where people on blocks are identified to work with vulnerable populations and check on them. They have cooling centers, and it's just a very, you know, sophisticated and comprehensive program. And just in the interest of time, I think I'm going to just talk a little bit about what we're doing. We, our Heat Island Reduction Initiative program, is very small. It's basically me. And we work on building capacity, so sharing best practices where possible, developing case studies. We have our Heat Island website. We partner with groups like ICLEI to host workshops and try to foster networks. And we work on filling gaps. For example, like I was saying, you know, cool roofs have really taken off, and we have our Energy Star labeling program, and, you know, it's kind of on its own now, or we don't need to do a whole lot more with that. But pavements, there really is not that much going on. So we're working with Arizona State University, who's formed this National Center of Excellence to kind of help advance the understanding and research and technology in that area. And further, I think, you know, urban heat islands, we're talking about surface treatments and vegetation. Really, it needs to be a larger planning issue, but I think we're just not quite there yet. But we are trying to work with urban climatologists and urban planners to kind of get the dialogue going to have a more holistic approach there. So here are a bunch of resources, and if you have any questions or want to contact me, I'd be glad to follow up. So, okay.